Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. While Wisconsin may be America's dairy land, there's no doubt that beer and brewing are a big part of our state's identity. The brewing industry was present in Wisconsin before it was declared a state, and the industry has played a role in the development of communities throughout the Driftless area. Joining us today to talk about the history of Wisconsin beer and its impact today is Doug Hoverson, author of a new book called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous. Doug, breweries were in Wisconsin, as I said, before we became a state, and the first commercial brewery was actually in Iowa County. I wonder if you can kind of share how this industry got started in our state.
Well, sure. The first breweries were really set up to serve the needs of the lead miners who were moving into the area around Mineral Point, where the first brewery was, and that entire area of Iowa and northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin was flooded with immigrants, many of them Welsh, who were miners in the old country and who, once they were here and working hard, decided they needed something to slake their thirst. And it became really expensive to ship something like ale into the region. So eventually John Phillips decided it would be profitable to set up his own brewery, and that became the first in the state.
And so I wonder if the tradition of home brewing that was also present in Wisconsin, you know, how maybe that influenced the commercial brewing industry?
Well, it's very likely that home brewing was going on beforehand. In fact, we have some fleeting documentation that there was home brewing all over the state before commercial breweries were in the area. But it seems it was one of those things that people didn't bother to write about because it seemed so natural. And as you say, I think there is a continuing thread of home brewing that goes through Wisconsin's history. It becomes especially important during the Prohibition years, when that was really one of the only alternatives for most people. And I think that tradition is really part of what helped the craft brewing boom get going, because without people who know how to brew and are interested in it, the breweries really don't have the labor force that they need to make all that beer.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the beer that was made during the late 1800s when this industry got started. I mean, how different is it from the drink that we know today?
One of my dreams, if I was allowed to time travel, would be to go back to around 1870 or 1880 and show up in Milwaukee or some other larger city on the day that the Bock beer was going to be released, so that I could test and see if it really was like what we know it as today. But I think by the time we get to the 1870s or 1880s, most of the commercial breweries have been able to use enough science so that they can regulate the fermentation temperature, they can evaluate the ingredients, and they're making very consistent beer. As far as the variety, there's a lot more variety back then than I think we sometimes think, because most of the major brewers were making several different varieties of lager. Sometimes they were making an ale and a porter as well. So a brewery in Milwaukee or some of the other mid-sized city might have made three or four or five different beers even in the 19th century.
So Milwaukee was obviously a central hub for beer in our state, but La Crosse was also considered a major brewing location. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what factors made La Crosse a good place for brewing beer.
La Crosse is really an amazing city because, given its relative size, it punches way above its weight class internationally as a brewing center. And I think probably the most important factor that separated La Crosse out from other cities of similar size was its location on both the river and several major railroad routes. It gave La Crosse a really good opportunity to expand their markets into Minnesota, into Iowa, and to the other states in the Midwest and the Mountain West, which hadn't had as much time to develop their own breweries yet, or hadn't had the type of immigrants who brought enough capital to start a brewery.
Yeah, so who were the major players in the early brewing industry in La Crosse, and how did that maybe change over time?
Well, there was a lot of movement back and forth. We think the first brewery in La Crosse was probably Jacob Franz, and it's not clear whether he started in 1850 or 1854. And one of the problems with researching this is we have evidence that there were breweries around before there were newspapers around that were interested in covering them. But within a few years, by the end of the 1850s, the big trinity of La Crosse brewers, the Heilemann, Gund, and Michael brewing empires, have all gotten started. And there was some movement back and forth. For a while, Michael was the biggest one, and then as we're heading into Prohibition, Gund was the biggest one. And of course, after Prohibition, Heilemann not only becomes the biggest brewer in La Crosse, but one of the biggest in the country, and really a major player in world markets.
Yeah, what do you think gave Heilemann its staying power and kind of contributed to this rise to fame for Heilemann Brewing?
Well, I think a big part of it was a skilled workforce. A lot of that was the German immigrants in the first place and their descendants. But I think moving into the post-World War II period, it was really just great management by a couple of their leaders, first by Roy Kumm and then Russell Cleary. And they had a vision for where they wanted to take the company. They had this plan, which was kind of revolutionary for the time, of buying up old breweries all over the country to get inexpensive brewing capacity, taking on some of their labels, and becoming a national brewer by becoming really a kind of multi-tentacled regional brewer.
Heilemann saw a huge boom, as you said, in the late 60s, early 70s. But eventually, you know, we get to the 80s and we see this merger and with another large brewing company. What happened that kind of led to Heilemann, you know, going that direction?
Well, there were several factors. And of course, the most dramatic one was the Australian financier Alan Bond coming in the heyday of the leveraged buyouts, buying Heilemann for way more than he probably should have, and ending up with massive financial problems and what was at the time the largest bankruptcy in Australian history. But Heilemann also had some other limiting factors, and that was that a lot of their breweries, both in La Crosse and around the country, were in constant need of upgrades, and they had old breweries that needed remodeling, they needed new equipment, and there was a lot of money that they were pouring into it. And at the same time, they had to put more money into advertising their beer to compete against the beer craze of the 70s and 80s, Miller Lite.
You know, I think one thing that's interesting about Heilemann is that kind of during its expansion period, you know, they were buying up other brands of beer and still keeping those on the market. And I just wonder if you can talk about maybe, you know, those different brands and why that move to keep those items on the market rather than just bringing them under a single brand.
What that really gets at is the amazing customer loyalty that many beer brands have had. And beer is really special in that way because there aren't a lot of companies and other businesses where the founder's name is still on the company generations later. And Wisconsin especially has great loyalties to its local beer brands, which is why so many of them survived. And Heilemann's strategy was to take some of those, for example, the Schmidt brand made in St. Paul, and keep those loyal customers and, if possible, move in some of their own labels like Old Style and Special Export, but really just to build on what was already there. Now, in the brew house, it ended up being the case that a lot of those beers were all the same thing and slightly different labels, but you know, you couldn't tell my grandfather that. He had his loyalty and he would never drink Schmidt, even though the beer he was drinking was really just Schmidt beer.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking about the history of beer in the Cooley region and beyond with Doug Hoverson, author of a new book called The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous. I want to talk a little bit about Old Style, because I think for this area, you know, it's definitely the most recognized Heilemann brand. And, you know, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the evolution of that beer.
Sure. Old Style goes back to the turn of the 20th century, and it was going to be Heilemann's big bottled product, and that was going to be the beer that they were going to start building their regional reputation with. And for people who have grown up in La Crosse recently and remember the world's largest six-pack with the old style shield labels on it, looking at some of the older labels in the book would be kind of a revelation, because they were incredibly busy labels with all sorts of scenes of brewing depictions. But Old Style became one of those great American lagers for quite a while. It was the biggest beer in Chicago, and it was popular all over the upper Midwest, and they had great commercials. And it was interesting because it was one of the last beers to actually talk about an important part of the brewing process in the ads. They talked about kreuzening, which is part of the fermenting process where you add a little bit of green beer into the, not green colored beer, but fermenting beer into the fermenters to get a nice carbonation to it.
You know, how did Heilemann's Brewing Company, how did that brewery end up in the hands of City Brewing, which is where we see it today?
That was a situation where after the Bond bankruptcy and after the merger with Stroh's, the brewery essentially shut down, but it was so important to the local economy that a number of local business people pooled their resources, pooled their talents, and made a move to restart the company again, and reverting back to its original name from the pre-prohibition era, which was the City Brewery.
You know, earlier you mentioned loyalty to beer in Wisconsin playing a huge part. And, you know, part of your book talks about the kind of history of brewing in small towns throughout Wisconsin, really, but also in the Driftless area. And I wonder if you can talk about how many of those hometown breweries kind of became a part of a city or a town's identity.
There were a lot of factors in that, and some of it was a matter of employment. It was often one of the larger employers in some of the river towns and some of the other places in the Driftless area. And part of it also was, even back before the craft brewing era, there were a lot of breweries that became the center of their community. They usually had a tap room where locals could come in and get a free beer or two or six. And there were real, you know, the breweries ended up sponsoring sports teams of all kinds, baseball teams, bowling teams. Even small breweries would sometimes sponsor a 15-minute radio program. And as a consequence, the name of the town, for in a case like, say, Arcadia or Fountain City, ended up getting spread far beyond what it otherwise might have. And it was a real source of pride for a lot of the people who lived there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Arcadia, because I wanted to talk about kind of a unique thing that, you know, that brewery did by offering a free public tap. I wonder if you can kind of share that story.
Well, basically, it was a situation where anyone who wanted to stop by the brewery and have a beer could do so. Sometimes in these public taps, the guests would all have their own mugs hanging on a hook or sitting on a shelf somewhere, and they could come in and pour as much as they want. Arcadia actually got in trouble with federal regulators at one point because beer that was not packaged for sale outside the brewery wasn't taxed. And at one point, Arcadia was reporting that 14 or 15% of their beer was being was going out untaxed. And it turned out that part of it was the tap room, part of it was also a leaky bottle filler, which made it look like they had way more people in the tap room than Arcadia probably even had. So they were getting questioned by the government, but it turned out they weren't actually doing anything wrong.
I mean, I think someone could look at that number today, a brewery, and, you know, think, how could they make money by giving away, you know, a significant portion of their beer for free?
Well, maintaining the local market was really critical for all these Wisconsin breweries, and especially the smaller town ones. And keeping the local residents happy and loyal was part of it. That helped generate business for the local tavern accounts and just keep the goodwill generally. There were a few smaller town Wisconsin breweries that tried to make a big push and get into Milwaukee or become exporting breweries, and they ignored their home markets for a while. And it was really tough to regain that support once it looked like they were trying to move beyond their loyal customers.
Another small town brewery I wanted to highlight was in Trumplo. And it kind of has an interesting story, mainly because of the brewery owners. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Jacob and Wilhelmina Melkwire.
Yeah, they seem to be one of those classic German couples of the 19th century. The accounts we have is that they were both large people who enjoyed the products of the brewery, though, again, the accounts also say they were also very good and enthusiastic dancers. And Jacob was the brewer, but he really wasn't interested in paying any of the taxes, but his wife insisted that they do that. So for a while, the brewery was actually in Wilhelmina's name for most of the official government documents.
Bangor, I think also their history of brewing, you know, kind of highlights a unique way that the breweries kind of helped municipalities and how they actually helped with local infrastructure. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how that brewery contributed to better, you know, water system in the municipality after a fire in the early 1900s.
Yeah, and that's a great example because as Heilemann advertised, it's the water, and the water is critical to brewing. It's the major component by volume, and good water will lead to a good beer. Even in these days when you can redo the water chemistry of your local water, it's still important to have a good tasting water. And access to municipal water meant that the water supply was going to be much more reliable. And Bangor, in the immediate pre-prohibition era, they really partnered with the city. And whereas the city owned the water mains, the brewery owned the pumps. They took care of supplying fire protection. They had the public fountains. So most of the water was actually coming from the brewery's equipment and being carried throughout the city. And when water restrictions were imposed during World War I, the Husa Brewing Company there was able to get around some of those water restrictions by pointing out they were actually providing city water. It was not just water for the brewery.
How do you think these breweries throughout, you know, southwestern Wisconsin area kind of set the stage for today's craft breweries?
I think a lot of that had to do, again, with the idea that they were a center for the community to gather. I've sometimes referred to brewery tap rooms as a late afternoon and evening coffee shop or coffee house where you can go sit around, talk, play games. Some of them are dog friendly and become a gathering place. I think another thing is that it is similar in a way to the mid-19th century when immigrants were coming over to start up new businesses. Now we have entrepreneurs who have developed a skill and would like to start a new business. I think the one way in which it's noticeably different than 150 years ago is the huge variety of different beer styles that are made by our craft brewers today.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up this, entrepreneurship in the brewing industry. I think that's a huge part of today's craft brewing industry. And I wonder if there are lessons that, current breweries can learn from the breweries that were started in our early history.
That's a great question, because one of the things I was really hoping to do was come up with some sort of thesis about why some breweries survived and some didn't. And I think my thesis ends up being is that there were a lot of different reasons, and most of the cases were individuals. Sometimes it was a matter of making good beer or bad beer, but there were a lot of breweries that made good beer that closed down. I think one of the reasons that a lot of breweries closed in the 19th and early 20th century was simply because they ran out of family members who were interested in keeping them going. And I think we're a little bit too soon into the craft brewing movement yet, because we haven't really seen too many second generation craft breweries going yet. But I think we're getting there. And as we start to have more breweries that are celebrating their 20th and 30th anniversary, we will see more about the staying power. But I think the breweries who have done a really good job staying in business are ones that have created a particular niche with particular styles of beer, and who have created an atmosphere in their tap rooms and around their product that's appealing to a large group of consumers.
In what ways do you think beer and brewing, the brewing industry, has influenced the development of the Driftless area? Are there impacts to our communities today that you think can be traced back to this start of this industry?
It's tempting to claim that everything in Wisconsin is somehow based on beer, and I don't really think I can go quite that far. But there are clearly aspects of many cities and towns' infrastructure and footprint that were in some way determined by the brewery. There are a number of cities that have a brewery street. The railroads in many cases had spurs added on to serve the railways. Sometimes the city even moved to accommodate the railway because of the brewery. And I think that in a lot of cases that brewery ended up being a major local landmark. Sometimes it was the tallest building in town. And I think throughout La Crosse especially, you can still see buildings, not just, of course, the Heilman Complex, but there are pieces of the Gund Brewery still on the southern side of downtown. There are bits and pieces of some of the other buildings around. There's even still some of the caves that other breweries like Diefenthaler used back in the 19th century.
Doug Hoverson, author of The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, joined us today to talk about how beer and brewing shape the Driftless area and the state, and what impacts the industry still has on our region today. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers.